Miss Guido can teach other lessons, too.
Oh, yeah.
The whole groups of people at one time. A village.
Oh, the whole old hundreds.
Yeah. That's an admonitory tale, the sort of thing that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah. You understand another story? I'll rush it.
Okay.
This is a long time ago. As the White Eyes count, yet not so far back on the time
arc. The what count?
The White Eyes.
The White Eyes, yes.
The people with the light-colored eyes. Mm-hmm. But not so far back on the time arch of the Anishinaabeg. there was a village of our people where this old hunter lived, and that was his name. They called him that anyway for a nickname. He was venerable in age, perhaps 100 years or more, yet active in the skills of the hunt, and eminently capable of performing his duties of instructing the younger generation. But they, disregarding the traditions of our people, never deferred to his knowledge, never asked his advice. In fact, they treated him as something of a nuisance and often made him the butt of their jokes. Now, one time the whole village was in preparation for a great hunt, which was to last for 7 days. And every man in the village was invited to participate, except the one who should have been the leader of the hunt. That final insult and rejection was more than old Hunter could bear. Within his lodge he prayed, "Forgive me, Master of Life, but my gift of long living is no longer an honor. It is instead a most miserable burden." And he consumed a lethal number of the Oshtemeg, which is, that's like an unholy way to refer to the Misquayo.
It means what, red talk?
Mm-hmm. It means redhead. It could also refer to a redheaded woman. She's not a good moral person. The spirit of the first consciousness had already, there's where you got it, had already left the old hunter as the band of younger men set out on their hunting journey. And thus it was that only old hunter's spirit of the second consciousness heard the departing hunters' jibes and jeers. "Take care of our women, old hunter," they said mockingly. A week later, a very despondent and an unsuccessful hunting party straggled back to the village. One of the young men stuck his nose gratefully in a bowl of stew and said, "Yeah, we didn't do so well. Probably we should have taken the old hunter with us." And his wife retorted, "There's a lot more than hunting lessons you could learn from that old one." And the story was out. While the hunters were away, a strangely different old hunter had been the guest at every campfire. And there wasn't a woman in the village, that is so the story goes anyway, that had not accepted the amorous ardor of old Hunter. And they say he was very good. At first they thought of it something, like a lark, But then it changed to near pandemonium as the women vied for his attention. And the news, of course, swept the village. And the men were enraged. Somebody said, "Kill the old hunter," and somebody else said, "Kill all the women." And then there was kind of a sort of a silence, and that didn't seem like a very good idea. At last, the matter was referred to the Council of Elders, and they debated over it, and they decided that this had happened because the traditions of the ancients had been ignored, that disrespect had been shown to old hunter, which was not according to the laws of the Anishinaabeg, and that this was the ancient mystery of the Misquayo in its role of wisdom and shield of honor, which was teaching them the error of their ways. And the men had been in the wrong, and the women too, and had brought all this trouble on themselves. And after that, that particular village was renowned throughout the whole area for its adherence to the traditional ways. And in the course of time, there were four infants born, whom everybody agreed had been conceived when the men were all out on hunt, and the sons of old Hunter. And these four boys grew to manhood and became mighty hunters. In fact, the mightiest that the village had ever known. And they were greatly respected. Fact is, their names are spoken to this very day.
There's another gift that the Misquito can give too, and that's of physical strength.
Oh yes, we've got a lot of stories about that. Which one shall I tell? Because I can't tell them all. There isn't enough time.
Okay. How about the one where the dock was built?
All right. And then there's two things I'd say. See, it shows how the gift of strength in the euphoric state, of which I said there's many tales, and it also shows how that a spiritual exercise by a group of dedicated people achieved a material benefit for the group. Our people very much needed a dock in this one spot, which is now called Indian Harbor. And they didn't have any machines to do it with. And if you know anything about the Great Lakes, in the winter the storms are terrible. They're unbelievable kind of terrible. You know, they'll take up old fish houses and smash them and that kind of thing. And every time they put up a dock, it didn't do any good at all. You know, by the time water was gone, no dock either. So they decided the only thing to do was to make one of rock, because up to that time all they'd had just was little landings for canoes, and the traders were coming in, and they knew that they could get a lot more money for their skins and for their maple sugar if they could have a boat come in and dock, and they could load a whole lot on at a time. So they drew quills, marked quills, porcupine quills, and all the men agreed that, you know, whoever drew these would take the Misquito, asking for the gift of strength.
It was like drawing straws.
Right. Exactly. And that's what happened. And all the men agreed, you know, that how that would happen. And there were nine men who drew a marked quill, and all the other men were to be their keepers, like, so that, to give them guidance so that their gift of strength in the euphoric state would be used wisely, and the strength would be used for the benefit of the people. And they directed them what to do, and those nine men moved all the rocks that built that dock. And it was a big dock and a long dock, and it lasted for many, many years. It was there until just about 15 years ago, and the DNR spent...
DNR is?
Well, the Department of Natural Resources of our state. I don't know how much money on engineers and dynamite to blow it up. They had a terrible time getting rid of it. They had to get rid of it because it was interfering with the passage of the yachts and the fishermen's boats up into the harbors so they could catch sport fish.
White men also used it for the same purpose too, didn't they?
Well, I don't think, yes. I mean, I don't think there was a lot of them that probably did, but there have been times when...
I understand there are herds of people who follow you around during mushroom hunting season.
Who told you that?
You did.
Oh. Yeah, but that's during morel time. The people around home are just crazy about morels, and they figure that all Indians, you know, have this sort of sixth sense, and they really do. You can't... I looked up one day, I was washing. You know, I was dressed, and there were three or four people, and they weren't looking at me. Lots of young women around there they could look at, but they were... just watching to see where I would go. And I just had been off to get some water down to the beach. They thought I was going for mushrooms with a pail. And so it's morels, though, that they do that.
On the island, an old farmstead, a very large one.
Yeah, a beautiful set, like an estate. Nobody else there would ever... This man, his name was Dane, and he had a big dream. Several barns, a fish house, a drying house, an ice house, a washing house. Even the dog houses were built to match the big house, and there was a walled garden and an herb garden, and the lady, it was fantastic. He was planning on using Indian labor, by the way, to keep it up. Anyway, he had a big dream, and I will have to say for old man Dane, he was willing to, you know, to work himself. It wasn't just that he was hoping somebody else would do it for him. And the part that applies is that he worked everybody awfully hard, and when he paid the Indians, well, they'd go off and get drunk. And then he'd get mad at them because he thought he paid them this magnificent sum of $2 a week. They should work harder and be more grateful. And he worked his own sons the same way. And finally, they couldn't take it any longer, and they just up and left with the help of some Indians who loaned them canoes and went over to the mainland. And there was old man Dane at the wrong time of the year, harvest time, and bumper crops of harvest, wheat and corn, God only knows what all to bring in. And just himself and a team of horses and his wife. And anybody but him would probably say, well, that's the end of that, but not him. He took one mosquito a day, and he brought that whole harvest in by himself and his horses. And I suspect his wife.
But he lost something in the bargain too, didn't he?
Yes, because of course his whole interest was just material gain for himself. So, I mean, he got the harvest in, and he got the money, and he got what they needed, but then he didn't have any sons to save it for. Last summer, the roof on that beautiful house fell in.
I've seen it. It was a nice place.
Really beautiful place.
There's some evidence, though, that not only did the Anishinaabe in the area we described earlier use it, but that there was a trade in it as well, isn't there?
Yes, there was a family that used to live over on a neighboring island, and these people were the real talent they had. They were part French and part Indian, and they had the best of everything. They were the richest people on all the islands. They had the best horses and the best house and the best food and the best boats and the best looking women, and they just knew how to make money. They were, you know, anything at all they could put their hand to, they made money on. And then this one time they tried selling mosquito. And they got a lot of money from it, people said. They certainly have the fanciest gravestones in the cemetery. Anyhow, they a long time ago, our people used to sell a bracket fungus that grew on the oak trees. It was very sturdy. It's called Didelia corsina. And it's one where you follow around with a pencil. But when it dries, it's very firm, and it makes an excellent comb. Now, our people used to use it just for their own hair, a little bear grease and wear. But when they sold it to Native American people who lived in areas where there weren't any trees, and therefore any fungus that grew on the trees, to use on their horses. And so there was a great trade route that along which these combs moved. And they went, you know, west to the plains where the people had horses. They made wonderful curry combs. But they make nice combs for your hair, too.
And you think this trade route was also the one that was used for mosquito? That's what these people did.
Yeah, but I think they reactivated that route.
But the Anishinaabe never did it for gain, never sold it.
Oh, no. There was all kinds of a real groundswell of a feeling against these brothers for doing that. I mean, even people who pretended they didn't know what the mosquito was were mad at them for doing it. They said, you know, but they just felt as if it wasn't the right thing to do at all.
The Anishinaabe, like the Mexican Indians, never in the old days sold the sacred mushroom.
Mm. Well, of course, there wasn't anything to sell them for, but they could have traded it for something, yeah. And they didn't do that either. No, you had to find your own, and it was that made it personal, your medicine, you see.
Well, I guess what we've done today was to show you that there's pretty good evidence for the use of Amanita muscaria in the northeastern part of this continent. and give you some idea of the way in which it was used, the feelings that people had about it. I guess what Gordon and I hope for is that things will happen the way they did when Gordon first made known to the world the use of psilocybe in Mexico, that more information will come forward. As Gordon said, he's the only person who's been willing to talk to us about it, but we know that there are other people out there. Perhaps when this sees print, that that'll happen. What we'd like to do now is, if you'd like, open up the discussion to questions. I know that there are certain aspects of usage and effect that people are interested in. Do you want to start that now? Could you raise a house? Anyone else? Idea that I think.
Yes, okay, we're all waiting. No, I'm real interested to find out why they were turning into zombies.
In many of the, in much of the ethnographic literature, when these things sort of, when these things are discussed or depicted, the you'll find that the motion takes place, and that there are radiating lines in from the depiction of the people taking it, and this seems to be an indication of the supernatural character of what is happening. If you're searching for a physical cause, I think you're not going to find it. It's the way in which
it's used. But you didn't say why the lines coming out. You meant the actual movement.
Yeah, I also meant the turning as well.
It is
both
true that that's the one on the scrolls and the glyphs are one indicates, like you said, spiritual force.
Could you speak louder, please?
Would you say it again, please? I prefer to have them that way. I prefer not to take the mushrooms. I'm sure that one pays. I think that it has a decided effect on your body after you've taken it for a length of time. Yes? Maybe one doesn't have to take a mushroom to see that.
Were there?
For what? It needs preparing is the people that are going to use it, and that's the mushroom. But,
well, we did that, didn't we?
Yes.